The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
Just by way of summarizing what we're trying to communicate as far as what we want to try and give to people or offer to people, I feel like right here in these two little cartoons we have two of the primary things, literally. People need someone that they can lean on, that they can depend on. And that is not only for comfort, but someone that they know will be honest with them. Someone that they know will call the shots the way they really are. And by the way, just for your encouragement, let me remind you that it has been demonstrated that one of the beginning reasons for depression is a recognition of irresponsible behavior. And getting away with it, if I can use that phrase. A person who knows they're behaving irresponsibly and doesn't have the self-control or the will to do something about it themselves and no one checks them on it is one of the most destructive forces in the beginning processes of depression. And incidentally, this has been demonstrated in children. Parents who allow their children to behave irresponsibly rather than holding them to limits begin a process of breaking down the whole concept of self-esteem. Self-esteem begins to be destroyed when I know I'm behaving irresponsibly and I'm not being checked by it or for it, either by myself or someone else. So one of the things that one of the most hopeful things that we can do for people is to call them on their irresponsible behavior. One of the most hopeful things we can do for people is to point out that their action is sin. Now, obviously the way in which we do that is very important. But the reason it's hopeful is that there's an answer for sin. If it's just an emotional problem, if it's just a neurosis or some other, you know, strange-sounding something or other, most people don't know what to do with that. But you say, well, it's, you know, it's a matter of sin and there is something to do about that. Now, whether they do it or not, it goes back to the matter of their response to the Holy Spirit, as we said earlier. But to have someone that they know they can lean on is very, very important. And then secondly, to have someone that will listen. Someone that will listen. And this brings up a statement by Paul Tournier, and many of you have heard me use this before, but let's re-examine it for just a moment. It's impossible to overemphasize the need that humans have to be really listened to be taken seriously, and to be understood. Now, the reason I keep using this statement is that I am just so impressed with the insight of that statement. At every level of interpersonal relationship, that statement can help us. The most intimate relationship, I find in my relationship with Florine, that if I can remember those three areas of need, it enhances our dialogue and our communication fantastically. Even after these 32 years, the 1 year of engagement and then the year of marriage in which we've become acquainted with each other. Or, in the most casual relationship, that is still true. And I've recommended to a number of our conferences where I've spoken that if people could utilize that concept in their ministry of evangelism, if people could be aware of those three areas of need, of the average individual on the street. And take time to listen, to take them seriously and to try to understand and build that kind of a bridge before we go charging in with, quote, giving them the gospel. I really believe that our evangelism would be far more effective. But I don't know how many of us really take that kind of time. Yes? All right, the question is, what does it mean to be taken seriously? I think that if a person is telling you about an area that they are struggling with, maybe it's something that you've dealt with and you've handled it so many times in one way or another that it's sort of inconsequential. And what you communicate, if you're not careful then, is good night. Why make such a big deal of that? That's what I mean by not taking them seriously. And incidentally, we can do that nonverbally. It's not just in what we say, it's in the look that we give. Someone recently, I can't remember the context exactly, but I was talking with him and I said, man, you know, I've been struggling with something in my own life. And this person, honestly, they weren't being facetious, though I could hardly believe what I heard. This person said to me, oh, come on, George, you don't have any problems. And I thought, wow, do I give that kind of an impression? Because the facts are I do. Anybody does. But you see, that person was not taking me seriously. So there are a number of ways in which we can communicate that, whether it's verbal or nonverbal. So this is what that statement means, Bob, to take someone seriously. Wherever they are, whatever it is they're expressing, to believe, okay, that's where you are, and I want to be able to understand that and to relate to it, and let's talk about it. Yes, Jim, thank you. Very good. Let me repeat just a little bit of that Jim White has shared with us regarding, this is for the tape, regarding the matter of those who are contemplating suicide, that people who express that need to be taken seriously. Because it's serious to them at that moment. Whether they follow through on it or not, it's serious to them at that moment. And so they need to be taken seriously because, as Jim suggests, it has been demonstrated that when we don't take them seriously, it's almost like the last straw. Because remember this little cartoon we had up here about someone to lean on? All of a sudden, the person they were leaning on, the support's gone. They didn't take them seriously. And that can be the straw that, as Jim suggests, just kind of overbalances the scale. Now, we said as we closed the last session that our goal is to try to bring about effective or try to effect positive change, effecting positive change in the person. Before we talk about that, let's remember that we are utilizing biblical guidelines to do this. The Bible does have answers, but more than that, the Bible gives hope. And this is what we must communicate. On more than one occasion, the thing that has sustained some people going through some difficult times has been that I have had hope for them. Even though they didn't sense it themselves, even though emotionally they didn't feel hope, if I could communicate from the Scriptures real hope and show them why I had the hope, somehow that sustained them for a period of time until we were able to begin to see the reality of it, and they began then to latch on to some hope as well. Romans 15:13 is a very favorite passage of mine, and you know it well. The God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. And then in verse 5 of that same chapter, it starts out by using two words that are part of the attributes of God. The God of steadfastness and encouragement grants you to live in such harmony and so on. But those two words, the God of steadfastness and encouragement, now that gives hope. The fact that He doesn't change. That the fact that we can come to Him under any circumstances and find the constant there. Someone to lean on, if you please. So in this matter of seeking to effect positive change, we start with the matter of personal responsibility, as we've already said. Second, the matter of hope, and that is that the moment that this individual is willing to take the responsibility for their behavior and take the responsibility of their action and begin to do something about it, that there is hope for change, as we'll see in just a moment. So, personal responsibility and the matter of hope. A willingness to take the responsibility and do what God says needs to be done. Now in that, it is often necessary to give positive steps to be taken. Now that doesn't mean I'm telling you to do what I've done. But wherever the Scriptures give us clear guidelines, such as the thing we saw in Matthew 5:23-24, and Matthew 18:15, which is the other side of that conflict coin, it gives definite steps regarding what should be done. And so you review that, and you draw them out. You specify, here's what I think you should do in order to fulfill what this says. A, you need to go to B, and you need to express where B has offended you, and you need to have a forgiving spirit, and you show them why, and you need to be willing to be reconciled, and you explain that to them. And you give them specific steps to follow. Not just a casual statement of, you got to go get it right with your brother, sort of a thing. But trying to give them some specific guidelines and some specific steps. In this area of hope, often what we need to do is review with them their concept of God. Now, we can't get involved in this, but I would like to suggest to you, just very briefly, that probably one of the basic areas of need and that brings about the greatest degree of problem, if I can use that word, or conflict, is a person's concept of God. Time and time again, this is where the real area lies. This is where the real problem lies, the real deficiency. And the focal point may be their living situation, because that's the closest thing to them. And they're having problems with the person they're living with, and their communication is broken down, and this person won't do this and won't do that, and so on and so on and so on. And yes, those things are real and they're irritating and we can't deny them. But did you pray about this living situation before you got into it? Yes, we did. And did you feel that God led you into it? Yes, we did at that time. You mean you did at that time, but you're not sure now? Well, sometimes they haven't even stopped to think of it. They haven't even stopped to realize that they're beginning to question whether God led them into that. Parenthetically, this is one of the big problems that we are facing in the marriage relationship field today. Do you think God led you into this marriage? Yes. Do you think it's still His will that you should continue this relationship? Well, I'm not sure. Did God change His mind? Did something happen? Or is it the person's concept of God and their commitment to what God showed them originally? So many times this is what we have to deal with. In a living situation, a job situation, do you think God brought you to work here? Yes, I do. But I just don't like the way things are going right now. Well, has God shown you that he's changed his mind? Well, no, but it's just too uncomfortable. Well, who in the world said, you know, that everything that God leads us into is going to be comfortable? But that's the concept that we allow to get into our minds. I was just reviewing a verse last week, and it was on my mind because I shared it with Jim this morning. It's 1 Peter 1, 13 through 16. And as I've reviewed this verse, there's just a whole lot of stuff in it, or this passage. Therefore, gird up your minds, be sober, set your hope fully on the grace that is coming to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, be holy yourselves in all your conduct, for he has said, or since it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Now, I can't take time, and I don't want to take time to go through that whole thing, but right in there, you've got the whole process worked out beautifully. First, let me just point these out quickly. Your mind. Gird up your mind. See, a lot of times that's where we have to start with people, in helping them affect positive change. Positive change takes place in your mind. What you do with your mind. Now, not by itself, of course. In the spiritual life and in the walk with God, it is God who empowers. But it is I who make the choice. And it says I'm to gird up my mind. All right, the second thing is, be sober. Now, if you have the New International Version, you'll find that it says something about being self-controlled. And that's what sober means in this context. Self-control. Or, if you please, moderation. Can't get into that. That's a tremendous study to get into right there. Just self-control and moderation. But now note, the next phrase says, set your hope fully on the grace that is coming to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Don't get bogged down in wanting everything you want in this life, but set your hope on the grace that is going to be yours when Jesus Christ is revealed. Right now, we're going to go through a lot of situations that are unpleasant. We are becoming a hedonistic society. That word hedonistic, or hedonist, H-E-D-O-N-I-S-T, has to do with trying to meet all of my personal desires. It is personal pleasure-oriented. And the society in which we live is becoming more and more that way all the time. And it is beginning to become part of the thinking of many believers today. Take the matter of fulfillment. Every person should be fulfilled. Right. What do you mean by fulfillment? If you mean that you should be able to have an enjoyable life where everything is just great, that's not true. Romans 5, 3 through 5 and other passages in James 2 and other places all speak to the value of tests and what tests produce in us. I didn't mean to get off on all this. What I'm trying to say then is when we deal with people, we have to help them recognize that usually much of their difficulty has to do with their concept of God. Am I here because God has me here? And if God wants me somewhere else, can't he remove me from this situation? In the meantime, am I willing to believe and to act on the basis of the fact that this is the best he has for me? And stop my complaining? You remember what it says in Hebrews, the 13th chapter? No, it's the 12th chapter, I'm sorry. Verse 12 and following. Therefore, lift up your drooping hands and strengthen your feeble knees. In other words, stop moping around and feeling sorry for yourself. And that's what we have to tell people sometimes. That's what we have to tell ourselves sometimes, isn't it? Now, the reason we start moping, and the reason we start feeling sorry for ourselves, and the reason we start complaining is because we've gotten our eyes off of the fact that God is in control. That's why. You remember that from Hebrews 12:3. Consider him who endured such contradictions of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint in your heart. So the concept of God, and in Hebrews 12, this passage I was talking about, it goes on and says, verse 15, see to it that no one fail to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness spring up and many be defiled. But all that has to do with my concept of God. Can God give me the grace for this situation? Or is this situation too hard for God? So very often, that's where we have to start in helping one another. In reminding ourselves of who God is. Our concept of God. See, and it's almost like we were talking about a while ago, this matter of A and B, only this time it's A, and it's the circumstance, and it's God. And if A is so concerned with the circumstance, we need to get them concerned with God. We need to help them remember that that circumstance is not an accident. It's not a mistake. God hasn't abandoned them, and so on. Well, sorry I took so long on that, but really I am so convinced that that's probably one of the basic elements of most areas of need that people get involved in. Is God in control? And can I be really happy with what God has given me? Who did I hear recently? Oh, Bob Vedano. Yeah. Remember Bob Vedano speaking to us here last week about God making me with no handles? Remember that? Complaining about how God has made me? But see, that has nothing to do with whether I have handles or not. It has everything to do with my complaining spirit. My concept of God. So anyway, that, to me, is the beginning of effective, positive change. Now let's talk about some other practical suggestions in this area of how to go about effecting positive change. Now I think we have to be honest enough to tell people that change is hard. Don't ever give somebody the idea that it's going to happen beautifully. That it's going to happen just because they say, Lord, I want you to change me, and you can do anything you want to make me the kind of a person you want me to be. That's tremendous. That's a great starting point. But see, not a great deal will happen as a result of that, other than some emotional euphoria for a while. Real change is a hard process of honest commitment and continual discipline. There is no shortcut. And we need to communicate that. We need to be very honest about that. And at that point, some people will say, well, it's not worth it. I'm not interested. And we can't do a thing about it. We can't do a thing about it. Some people love to be miserable. And God has reserved the right for everybody to be miserable. He has not taken that away from us. That's a tragedy. It really is. But you can choose to be that way. And the people you're trying to help might choose to be that way. Let's talk for a moment about this matter of temperaments, because it enters into this. There's a lot being said about temperaments today. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about temperaments. I think some people use temperament as an excuse. I am a such and such of kind, so I can't do thus and so. I'm a phlegmatic, so please don't try and help me to become disciplined. because I just sort of, you know, bob and weave wherever I feel like bobbing and weaving. Or other things. You know, I'm a melancholic, so I can't be joyful. And I've had people say to me, I'm a certain temperament, that person is a different kind of temperament, and that's why we can't relate. And of course, all of those are just excuses. They are not factual statements. None of those. There are some inherited traits that are genetic. We cannot deny that. We're different. Every one of us is different. And we shouldn't try to make each other be like anybody else or put handles on anybody, as Bob said. But we have three areas that we have to deal with, basically. The area of, I'll use the word temperament because we're familiar with it. The area of temperament, the area of personality, and the area of character. Temperament, personality, and character. Now, these, as I said, this first grouping, are basically genetic. We're born with certain tendencies. Let's group those under this concept of temperament. The personality is how these temperamental qualities exhibit themselves outwardly. What you see of me, how I respond to situations. So that's pretty much what we are. This is what I'm like, and this is how you see me. The temperament and the personality. Now, the important thing is to realize that the Bible doesn't deal with either one of those. It's a totally silent area. The Bible deals with character. And character always supersedes temperament or personality. Character is what I am in my thinking processes. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for out of it are the issues of life. So character is what I think. My own convictions. And it is character that God is seeking to change in Romans 8:29. He is seeking to conform us to the image of His Son. It is character that is being dealt with in Galatians 5:22 and 23 and other passages that have to do with my growth and development. As that character develops, it will influence my, quote, temperament traits. Let's take the traits as we know about them. As just basic identification. Let's take a man who is very choleric, okay? He's an activist. He likes to get things done. He tends to run over people to get things done. He is insensitive. These are some of the definitions that are given to us in the books. He is insensitive to the people around him. So he's a choleric. We know a few of those. But if he is going to take personal responsibility, and here we're back to that again, then he can never excuse his insensitivity to people and his carelessness in dealing with them on the basis of the fact that that's the kind of a person he is. Because the scriptures in character development speak very specifically to the way we should treat one another. That has to do with my thinking process. That has to do with my conviction that that is the kind of a person God wants me to be. And that kind of conviction or thinking process will override these temperamental qualities if I'm willing to allow the Spirit of God to do that as I apply those truths in my life. Now, as that happens, as that takes place, as my character dominates my temperamental responses according to biblical guidelines, that is what people will see. And in fact, I will have a new, if I can use that word, or at least a refined personality. So here's what we're talking about then in this matter of effecting change. That's what we want to see happening in people's experience and in people's growth processes. Now, I'm not going to get involved in this to any great degree, but this is what we've tried to talk to and speak to in the little booklet, Changing Thought Patterns. And by the way, the little booklet that I've written has been revised and is in the process of being printed. I don't know where that is right now, but it'll be out, I suppose, shortly. And we've tried to amplify it a little bit and add some things to it, but it speaks to this issue. So I won't go into all of that, because I'd rather you get the little booklet than just have it as a reference point. But let me speak to two or three things. Turn with me, if you will, to Colossians 3, 1 through 12. I think we have a terrific passage here to help us understand what it is we're saying about this matter of effecting positive change. In here, we're not going to take time to read it, but in here, we have a series of statements that have to do with putting on and putting off. But the first statement is in verse 2, set your minds. Now there we are back again to that concept that we saw in 1 Peter 1, 13. Gird up your minds. Here it says, set your minds. So it begins with what I do with my mind. And this is what we have to help our people recognize. Because so often they say, they talk about how they feel. And now here we're getting into a little area that really requires more time than we can take this afternoon. Feelings are very important. Let's never minimize feelings. Don't just overlook them casually. Don't say to somebody, well, yeah, I know you feel that way, but if you do this, you'll get over that. Because that may not happen exactly. It is true, let me say this, it is true that feelings always follow action. Never the other way around. Now that is a fact. Feelings follow action. But that doesn't mean that we can casually ignore somebody struggling with some feelings. Here we go back to Tournier's statement. They need to know that you're willing to listen, take them seriously, and try to understand. What I recommend is that we allow people to express their feelings. Now, one of the problems is this. We don't state it, but the facts are that very often we communicate that Christians shouldn't feel certain ways. That's communicated in a very indirect way sometimes. Somebody says, boy, you know, I'm really struggling with resentment. And you say, you? Really? As if it's, you know, sort of, that shouldn't happen. Because you've been a Christian 20 years. How can you be struggling with resentment? And unintentionally, we communicate that that's something that a Christian shouldn't experience. Now, what I'd like to suggest to you is the fact that feelings are neither good nor bad. They simply are. They're just there. We have them. Now, what we do with those feelings is our responsibility. We're back to responsibility. So sometimes I just need to get the feelings out and express them, talk them over with somebody, and deal with them. Jim. Yes. Feelings are the initial responses that I have to given stimuli, whatever that is. Might be a situation, might be a person, might be a job, might be a responsibility. I have a response to that. That's how I feel about it. Now, if I allow that feeling to go unattended, and this can happen in a variety of ways, I can submerge it, I can pretend it's not there. Someone says to me, are you having problems with resentment, George? No, man, not at all. And down inside I may be churning away, but I don't want to admit it. If I do that, if I allow that feeling to persist without dealing with it, it will begin to affect my way of thinking, and that becomes the beginnings of an attitude. So my attitude is a response or a result to unattended feelings that begin to affect my thinking. Now, I said earlier, feelings follow action. So if I feel a certain way, and I'm willing to express it, admit it to myself, deal with it before God, if necessary, express it to someone that can help me, but get it out and deal with it and not let it control me, then that feeling has been dealt with. It's taken care of. And it will not persist and it will not create further antagonisms that can lead to attitudes. But that action has to be on the basis of what I know is right and not on the basis of how I feel. I can never, remember now I said we can admit feelings, but we must never allow feelings to be the basis for action. I cannot allow myself to act on the basis of how I feel. I have to act on the basis of what I know is right or wrong, as the case might be, in my response pattern. So, we have to begin by setting our minds, our thinking processes, not allowing our feelings to be our motivating process, but our cognitive, intellectual thinking process, setting our minds. Then he goes on and he says in verse 5, put to death, in verse 7, put away, and in verse 10, put on. So you have here the pattern that I want to express, the put off, put on principle, which is very important in effecting positive change. You put something off and you put something on. Let's go back for a moment to this passage in 1 Peter that I referred to a moment ago. This is exactly what Peter is saying. Get your minds where they belong. Gird up your minds. Second, self-control. Don't give in to your feelings. Self-control. Don't expect to be fulfilled in the wrong sense of the word, to have all of your pleasureful desires met. But rather it says, set your hope on the grace that is coming to you. Now here's the put off, put on part. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. In other words, put away your patterns of action, former ignorance. Put away all those things that you did before. Put them off. And instead put on holiness. He goes on to talk about that. So there's the put off, put on process. But to get it more specifically, go with me, if you will, to Ephesians 4. We have two or three very, very specific illustrations in Ephesians 4 of the put-off, put-on process. First of all, beginning with verse 25. Ephesians 4, 25. Therefore, putting away falsehood, put off. Let everyone speak the truth with his neighbor, put on. What's he saying? Stop lying and start telling the truth. It isn't enough to stop lying. You see, a liar doesn't stop being a liar just because he stops lying. That's only the first step. He stops being a liar when he becomes a truth teller. You put one process off, but you put another process on. And simply to get somebody to admit, yes, I'm wrong, I shouldn't do that, and I won't do it again, is only half the battle. What are you going to do in its place? See? The next illustration in chapter 4 of Ephesians is in verse 28. Let the thief no longer steal. Okay, put that off. Don't steal anymore. Right. I'll never steal again. Is that the end? No. Rather, let him labor, doing honest work with his hands, so that he may be able to give to those in need. Not only is he not to steal, he is to get a job, work, and give money to people to keep them from stealing. So you put off a negative, and you put on a positive. You put off a wrong way of acting or thinking, and you put on a right way of acting or thinking. There's one other illustration, which is obvious as well, and that's verses 31 and 32. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander and all ta-ta-ta-ta be put away. Okay, great. But in their place, it says we put on kindness toward one another. We put on tender-heartedness toward one another. We put on a forgiving spirit. It's not that we stop being nasty. It's that we start being Christ-like. And this is what we have to help people understand. This is what it means to begin experiencing real positive change in my life and in the lives of those that I'm trying to help. Let me give you, in closing this session here very quickly, these will just help kind of put all of this in a little sequence. One, the first thing is becoming aware of the pattern that must be put off. That's the first thing we have to help them clarify. Becoming aware of the pattern that must be put off. They have to see it. They have to recognize it. Now tell me, why is that important? Why do you think that's important? Yes. Okay. Basically, because unless they know there's a need, they're not going to look for much change. Good. What else? There's another good reason why we should help them at this point. Excellent. They'll recognize it more quickly the next time as they see it developing. So that's part of this identification process, to help them not only admit the need, but to be able to recognize it as it starts to happen on another occasion. Okay, the second thing, discovering the biblical alternative. Discovering the biblical alternative. And that is very important. Remember, we said it isn't enough just to say, okay, I'm going to stop doing that. I have to know what I am going to start doing in its place. And so we have to have in mind a biblical alternative that we can help them find. All right, then third. Structuring the whole situation for change. Structuring the whole situation for change. Now, this may mean trying to help them think through how they're going to put that into practice in their job, let's say. Maybe it's something they're struggling with on the job. Okay, sitting down with them and saying, okay, how do you think we can do this on the job? How are you going to stop being critical of Mary and start being constructive? How are you going to stop feeling resentful towards, you know, whoever it is when they give you a job to do and you've already got one that you're working on? And trying to put it into a very practical frame of reference and giving some guidelines as to how to structure that change in a practical situation. The fourth thing he suggests is breaking the links in the chain of habit. Breaking the links. Now, by that he means trying to help them not only recognize what triggers it, the stimulus that triggers it, but how to break that immediately when it starts. How to recognize it and how to say no to it. That initial thing that happens, whatever it is that triggers the situation. I've had some husbands or wives say to me, whenever he says thus and so, or whenever she says thus and so, boy, I just really react. Well, that's an easy one to identify then. Then you just have to help them say, all right, are you willing to say, the next time he says thus and so, I know what my reaction is going to be because it's been that way so many times, but instead I'm going to stop and I'm going to say to myself, hold it, I'm not going that way. I'm going to do this instead. And you allow, listen carefully, you allow the same stimulus that has produced a negative pattern to begin producing a positive one. The very same stimulus. If you can identify it. Then, the fifth thing he suggests is getting help from others. Getting help from others. And I think that's a good thing. I think that you need to encourage them to, perhaps with their roommates or perhaps with a close friend, to share some of what's been happening or what you've shared with them or what you've suggested, and let them get some input from some other people. There may be some suggestions that someone else can make that can be very, very helpful. Yes, thank you. As I said, Terry, and I don't mean to use this as an excuse, I jumped over that because it's in the little booklet, but I'd like to speak to it at this point. Philippians 2, 12, and 13, I think, is the sequence that to me is very clear. In the 12th verse, the statement is made, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Other versions speak in different terms, but they all say the same thing. Basically, take responsibility for your actions as a born-again follower of Christ. That's what it's saying. So, that's my responsibility. And it's that responsibility that I'm talking about at this point. The fact that I am responsible to control my mind. Gird up your mind, set your mind, fix your thoughts, Philippians 4:8, and so on. So that part of responsibility is mine. I have to begin there. Now the moment that I take that initial step, God promises to bring to bear His strength. And it's in the Berkeley that the translation says, God will energize me, or you, to will and do of His good pleasure. So I take that first step of recognizing my personal responsibility in the way I think, in controlling my mind, in the way I react, in the way I respond. I take that initial step. I make a choice by an act of my will, but that's as far as I can go. The change is effected by God in that second verse, verse 13. God is the one who energizes that I might be able to fulfill that. And this is what we said at the beginning, that the effecting of real change is something only God can do. I do my part, I accept my responsibility, But God is the one who brings about the change in my life. Now, the thing is this, and we'll stop with this. It has to be repeated over and over again. Particularly where it is a habit that has been there for many, many years. Because like any habit, you have to dehabituate, which is a perfectly proper word. You have to dehabituate yourself in that area. You've learned a habit, and now you're trying to break it. And the only way to do that is deal with it each time. And there's nothing miraculous that takes place that all of a sudden I'm delivered from that, but there's a process of growth so that each time I deal with it, it is less gripping on my life, and my deliverance from it is greater and greater. And this is one of the most hopeful things that I can communicate to people when we're dealing with long-standing habit patterns. And it has been absolutely delightful to watch people change, really change in their lives as they begin putting into practice some of these very simple concepts of how to effect positive change. Now, in the next hour that we have, I would like to open it up for questions, and I'd like for you to think while we're drinking our coffee and stuff, whatever questions you might have or clarification that might be needed, the kind of thing you just asked Terry to put into balance some of the things I've been saying. We've been moving very quickly, and I realize that we've been touching on a lot of things. Some of them may not be clear. Some of them you may want to challenge, and I'd appreciate it if you would feel free to do that in the next hour.